Hi, I'm Jack O'Halloran, the Kryptonian Non from Superman and Superman 2. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello, superhero celebrants. Welcome to Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, and the lair continues to be decked out in red, blue, and yellow as we continue our celebration of the 75th anniversary of Superman and the 35th anniversary of my favorite comic book movie of all time, Superman the Movie. December 10th, 1978. That was the date of the Washington, D.C. premiere. And if you're listening to this podcast on December 15th, well, that's the day the movie hit theaters across America. But no matter when you're listening, any time is the perfect time to watch the film. Hope you enjoyed the last episode, my interview with executive producer Ilya Salkind. Thank you again, Ilya, for presenting the cinematic masterpiece to us. Today, I'm sitting down with one of the actors from Superman the Movie. He played the Kryptonian villain, Non. Now, he and his fellow Kryptonians, Zod, kneel before Zod! And Ursa returned to menace the Man of Steel in Superman 2. Take a listen to this, and I'll be right back with Jack O'Halloran. Born in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Jack O'Halloran was a heavyweight boxer who fought coast to coast, Philly, Boston, Los Angeles. And while he was on the West Coast, he won the California Heavyweight Championship in San Diego. Upon retiring from the ring, Jack took up acting and went from knockout punches to knockout performances in such movies as Farewell, My Lovely with Robert Mitchum and King Kong with Jeff Bridges. Pretty soon, Jack landed the role of Non in Superman the Movie. His character is banished to the Phantom Zone pretty early, but in the world of Superman, it's pretty tough to keep a Kryptonian down. Well, he is an actor, he is an author of the book Family Legacy, a former professional boxer, and a Kryptonian monolith. Let's welcome to the show Jack O'Halloran. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you very much for asking. Did you have a nickname during your boxing days?
Oh, God, I had a dozen of them. Irish Jack, Jack the Giant, Irish Jack probably the most.
Let me ask you this. What's tougher, going toe-to-toe with George Foreman or with a Hollywood executive?
That's a good question.
Which one would you prefer, maybe?
I would like to have the Foreman fight back, but I Hollywood executives aren't that difficult, actually. Depends on how you're coming at them and what you're there for.
Do you dress in all black when you go after them?
No, I wear my Krypton suit.
That would be a little intimidating. Well, you know, we talked a little bit about the boxing there. You had initially planned on a career in sports as opposed to acting, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
How did that get started? What sports were you into? How far did this progress?
Well, When I was younger, I played football, basketball, track, wrestled a little bit, but mostly track and basketball and football. I went to school for a couple of years, and when I left school my sophomore year, in those days you couldn't play in the NFL until your class graduated from school. You weren't allowed to play in the NFL. They didn't have hardship cases then. So Webb Eubank really liked me a lot, and I went up and I tried out with the Jets, and they put you on like what they call it was almost like farm baseball teams, you know?
Right.
They had on the East Coast, they had a semi-pro league that was tied into some NFL teams that their playbooks were used, and it was a tough way to go because you were playing like three games a week both ways just to keep your levels up, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was kind of a tough scenario, but I did it, and it was good. You know, I had a lot of fun, met a lot of people, and then when I was eligible to play in New York, Philadelphia had put together a phenomenal young team, and I knew a lot of the ball players that were going down there, and they had Jurgensen at the time, and they had drafted Randy Beisler, who was an all-pro guard, and he was a great ball player from Idaho. And they had a lot of good young talent. It was a good team. And Jerry Wallman had just bought the team, and I was very friendly with him and Eddie Snyder and some other people. And they asked me if I would come down and play in Philly. So I went to Eubank, and I said, you know, I'd like to go down and play a year or two in Philadelphia, because I had nothing contractually with the Jets other than I could have went on their roster that year.
Well, that would have been perfect for you, because you're a Pennsylvania guy, right?
Yeah. So I went down and I talked to Philly, and then they hired Joe Kuharik, which was a disaster. I mean, I watched this guy trade a championship football team away. I mean, he traded Jurgensen and McDonald for Norman Snead, who was a joke. And then he traded five of the best young linebackers to Green Bay for an aging Jim Ringo, which was a disaster. And then he traded Maxie Bawn and Irv Cross to L.A. for a kickoff return guy that they never even got, I don't think. And he
What's that
traded,
do to you as a player? I mean, when you're seeing all this going down, you know, you're like, ah.
I watched this guy do this, and I remember we came out of a team meeting one day in 30th Street, and Timmy Brown and I, and Kuharik walked by us, and I said hello, Joe, and he like almost snubbed us, and I turned around, and I said, hey, Kuharik, take this team and stick it, and he said, what? And I said, I'm done. And Timmy Brown said, while you're at it, trade me. Because he was an all-pro running back, you know. He was a great ball player.
And that was it.
And he got traded to Baltimore, I think. And I went, I went to see some friends of mine. And Ali had just won the title. And I said, man, I could knock that cat out. And the guy said, you know, that's a good idea. Let's, you know. So I went in the gym and I came down from like 290 pounds to 230 pounds.
Wow.
And I trained for 6 months, and I couldn't box amateur because you were considered a professional. And in those days, you couldn't do two things like that. You know, today you can do that. You know,
now, why were you considered a professional? Because of your athletic background?
Well, I had an agreement with the Eagles, and I had an agreement with the Jets, you know, so that you're considered professional because you were on the schedule to play. I was going to play in Philadelphia that year.
Okay. But even then, as a boxer, you were considered a professional because you were a professional athlete?
Well, you're a professional athlete. So
okay.
You're a professional in every sport.
Wow. You know? Okay. Even though you were just getting into boxing.
Yeah, I mean, wow. I had never boxed before, so okay. I did my amateur career in a gym, and I had a lot of street fights, you know.
A quick learning curve.
Yeah, and I was just a tough Philadelphia kid, you know. So I went in the gym, and things turned out pretty well. And
yeah, you started off on fire, right?
Yeah, I had a great crew around me, but you know, I was. You have to understand, you're a Pennsylvania guy, you know, I was a street kid, you know what I mean? I had a, it's in my
I think your streets were a little different than mine, though.
Well, the book, my book tells something that I never told people in those days. And, you know, it was, my father was a kind of a nefarious guy from New York, and I was very much involved in that world, and so I was using boxing as a daytime job.
Aren't familiar with the book, tell them who your father was.
Albert Anastasia. He was a New York guy who was...
And if that name's ringing any bells for individuals?
Well, he was partners with Meyer Lansky and Charlie Luciano and Frank Costello, and he was the head of Murder Incorporated.
Okay. Now, and you highlight this in the latest book, right? Family Legacy?
Yeah. Yeah, Albert was probably one of the most feared men that ever came into America. Anyway, he was, you know, so I was involved in his world a lot. And I used boxing. And, you know, if certain people would have been home from jail, Frankie Carbo and a few other people, I probably would have been heavyweight champion of the world.
Unbelievable.
And I just... I had a lot of natural talent, and I was very foolish and misused it. And I don't, you know, I kick myself in the butt, but, you know, you can't live yesterday. It's gone. You know, I had a lot of great opportunities, and, you know, I did a lot in boxing. I went all around the world. I beat a lot of good fighters. I lost fights I should have never lost. I took fights on 24-hour notice.
That's, you know, crazy. I mean, I read up on that, and that's unheard of today.
Well, yeah, no one would ever think about it. I mean,
you can't do. Like, how do you turn around a fight in 24 hours?
They called me up to fight Ken Norton. They called me up to fight Ken Norton.
Like less than a week, right?
Yeah. Guys, will you fight Norton next week? And I had 16 indictments against me on the East Coast for union problems and stuff like that. And I said, where's the ticket at? He said, you'll take the fight? I said, where's the ticket, man?
So we'll take the fight and take the flight.
Sent me a ticket, and I went out, and I trained 4 days for the fight. I gave Kenny the worst beating he ever had. And I could have won the fight actually sitting on the stool. In the ninth round, we were standing toe-to-toe, and he was bleeding. I cut him up pretty bad, and he was the referee,
decision?
People were standing on the chairs screaming so loud, and they rang the bell. Nobody heard it. So they rang the bell like three or four times, and the referee finally separated us. And I was going back to my corner, and he ran across the ring and hit me behind the head and drove me into the corner post. And the commissioner, Joey Almas, come up in the corner, and he said, if you can't continue, you just won the fight. And I said, I was so mad. I said, I'm going to kill this guy. Are you kidding me? And I get out in the 10th round. I said, what am I doing here? I'm in Kenny Norton's hometown. And
You should have taken his advice.
Unless I knock him out, you know, there's no way I'm getting a decision. So, I you know, the fight went the distance, and I won the town. I mean, people thought I won the fight. And
it's like Rocky. You lost the decision, but you won the town, right?
Yeah, it was a great. So I stayed there, and I knocked out a half dozen people, and one of them was Ali's brother, which was a funny story. He called me on the phone one day, and he said, "You got to do me a favor." And I said, "I'll do you a favor."
This is Muhammad Ali calling you.
Yeah, so I said, sign a contract for us to fight, and I'll do you a great favor. He said, and he laughed. He said, you know, I'll make it, we'll do it. He said, but you're fighting my brother this week, and you got to get him out of boxing because he's hurting me. I said, Rockman's your brother? He said, yeah. So I said, oh, man, I better go in the gym. I was shooting pool at a bar, and I said, I better go in
knocking
the gym.
Knocking back a few cold ones. And
Yeah, a few beers, you know.
So I'll fight him.
I went to the gym for a couple of days, and I knocked him out in the ninth round. He never fought again.
You did your job.
Yeah.
But you didn't get the Ali. You didn't get the real Ali fight.
Ali and I were supposed to fight. When he fought Norton, that was supposed to be my fight. He agreed to fight me.
Okay.
And we had put a great deal together in San Diego. And Bob Byron and Art Rifkin owned Kenny Norton, and they were very wealthy guys. And they went to Chicago, and they made a deal with Herbert Muhammad. And Ali called me on the phone, and he said, I don't know how to say this to you. He said, but I really apologize. It's out of my control, and I have to fight Norton. And I said, okay. And he said, but I was going to fight him in Australia, but he fought Bugner down there, and then we were going to fight another. But we were signed like four different times, but it just never happened.
Was that what ended your boxing career?
No, I went on, fought until 1974.
Okay.
I was before I fought Norton.
Okay, so you get this offer for the Great White Hope?
Yeah, which I turned down, and I had met Steve McQueen in Boston. Steve McQueen was doing Thomas Crown Affair. He wanted me to come out to Hollywood. I was going to do Thomas Crown Affair. We looked after him when he was in Boston, and I was starting my boxing career up there. We became pretty good friends.
But you'd never done any acting or anything, had you?
No, never.
Okay,
no,
so just this.
The only thing I ever did was I did some commercials when I was California heavyweight champion out of San Diego. I did commercials for Royal Crown Cola and for the Clippers. And so I knew, and my timing was always good. And And when I turned down The Great White Hope, and I turned down a few other pictures. And
why'd you turn them down?
I didn't think that career was for me. I was doing a lot of things, and boxing took me around the world and gave me a great excuse to take care of business in different parts of the world.
Did the thought about getting in front of a camera, was that in any way intimidating or anything like that?
No.
Just didn't feel right.
When I retired from boxing in 1974, they called me on the phone and said, they want you to do a movie. And I said, what movie? And I said, Farewell, My Lovely, starring Robert Mitchum. And it's a starring role, and you should really consider it. And I said, I'd just done boxing, and I looked around where I was at, and I said, you know, okay, what do we got to do? And I went up to New York to meet the director and at the Sherry Netherlands. And he said, wow, you're the guy. And I said, yeah, right. So he called me up a couple of days later from California. He had to go back and talk to Elliot Kastner. And they flew me out to do a screen test. And Jerry Bruckheimer picked me up at the airport. I went and did a screen test, and Robert Mitchum said, it's either him or I don't do the movie.
Wow.
And
why do you think he said, what was it about your...
I just had a real natural.
Acting.
I had a natural deal for it, you know.
Okay.
It just worked really well, and had a great look that they wanted for Moose Malloy. And I don't know if you've ever seen Farewell, My Lovely. It's actually a classic picture today. It's a great film, actually.
Well, and Mitchum. What better way to start in the acting career than with Mitchum?
He was great. He was like, he and I became like father and son. Robert and I were very close. You know, it's a great loss. His death. He was a great mentor. I mean, he took me by the hand, boy, and he just walked me right through the industry, and he showed me exactly what to do and how to do it. And he was great. I mean, you couldn't have a better entree to the film industry, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get much bigger than that. What kind of roles were you then offered? I mean, were they similar parts that were coming up, or what were you finding in Hollywood? How was that experience for you?
From Farewell, My Lovely, I was, they wanted to, I probably would have got nominated that year had I done what some people asked me to do. Robert had set up a meeting for me with Johnny Carson, and Johnny Carson said, if you do my show, I'll get you nominated for Farewell, My Lovely. And I said, wow. So I went and met him at the Polo Lounge, and, we sat down, and and I said, and his show was live then. And I said, your show's live. And he said, yeah. I said, that's a problem. He said, what are you talking about? He said, you come on the show, it'll be great. And, you know, everything will work out well, and you'll get nominated for the picture. And I said, I can't do your show. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm going to come on your show. You're going to ask me about my father, and I'm going to get up and leave. Because he knew about me because Mitchum told him everything. And he said, no. He said, oh, we'll give you a list of questions we're going to ask you. And so I said, listen, I said, you know, you're one of the top investigative reporters. And you have Albert Anastasio's son on your stage. And nobody's allowed to talk about my father. And you're not going to ask me questions about my father? You think I fell off a turnip truck or what?
Especially live.
And he said, well, what would you do? I said, I'd get up and ask you where the men's room was. He said, and you would get up and leave? I said, yeah, I would. And it was dumb because, you know, Mitchum said to me, what, are you crazy? I said, well, you know, Robert, I'm not ready. He said, Jack, it's Hollywood. Who cares? Nobody gives it. You know, they just don't care. It would have been, and he was right.
You could have just given a no comment.
Well, I should have done it. I should have done the show, but you know, but I didn't. And I don't kick myself for that. You know, I just went on. So I then the pictures just I started doing picture after picture. I got a lot of offers, things I turned down, and then they offered me King Kong, and I did King Kong, and I set a record at my agency for working 8 months in a row on a picture.
That was a huge movie.
Yeah. Yeah, King Kong worked out well. And while I was doing King Kong, they offered me three other pictures that I could have. We had a break in King Kong. I could have went and done a picture with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, which I should have done. I turned down several pictures and made Richard Kiel's career. turned down the Bond picture.
And, well, I was going to say, for those listening who may or may for those listening and may not know who Richard Kiel is, give him what's his most famous role?
Probably Jaws.
Yeah,
in the
Bond movies, and that could have been you.
They came to me to do it, and I turned it down. They came to me, and I had signed to do a picture called March or Die with Gene Hackman and Catherine Deneuve and Bruce Bouvier, with great cast, Max von Sydow. And I should have probably done the Bond movie, but then I did Superman right after March or Die. So.
Well, I was going to say, if you'd done that, we might not have gotten Superman and Superman 2 out of you.
It just happens what's supposed to happen, you know?
There you go. Well, you know, how did the Man of Steel come into your life at that point?
I did a picture of March or Die, and the crew from March or Die was, most of them were going to go from that to Superman because they were English kids. It was an English crew. And David Tomlin, who was the first AD, said, Richard Donner would like to talk to you. And I said, and Gene Hackman was on the picture, March or Die, with me. And he said, I think you should go talk to Donner about Superman. There's a character there that they probably would want you to do. And so I went to London, and I met with Richard Donner, and he asked me to do Non. And I liked the idea because... I wanted to do a character that didn't speak. Jackie Gleason did a picture called Gigo.
The mute Frenchman.
Yeah, and he won an Oscar for it. And he was, and his body language was phenomenal. And I thought that was brilliant. And I said, you know, I would love to be able to do a picture where I could do it with expressions and body language, you know?
Now, when you're meeting with Donner, had the character of Non been, because he's not from the comic books, he's original for the film, but had the character been developed that you saw, this was a mute, or did you kind of collaborate?
The character was a genius scientist, and they lobotomized him because they were scared of him.
Okay, now that's interesting you're saying that, because now we're getting a little bit of background here, because I was going to ask you later in the interview if you've ever read the comic book that Richard Donner co-wrote with Jeff Johns, Last Son, where they talk about that backstory. So you're saying that when the movie was pitched to you back in the mid to late 70s, that was the background for Non?
Yeah. You know, and I liked the idea of him not talking. You know, I thought I said, that's brilliant. They said, do you have a problem with that? I said, no. I said, I really like that. I like the idea that he was this huge animalistic individual. But he was child mannerism, like, you know,
because he'd been lobotomized.
Yeah. And somebody had to relate to kids. I mean, you know, you had Zod, who was this fierce killing general, and Ursa, who was this fierce killing woman. Neither one of them were really singled in on kids. You
understand? They're not kid friendly.
So somebody had to relate to the children. And I said, you know, I want to take that role on. Yeah. And Donner said, wow, what a great idea. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, I really like to emphasize this child mannerism like thing, you know, and the tribute to Zod when I tore the light off And you know, different things, the way I attribute it to when I burnt the hole in the side of the truck and the little kid was there, and I jumped up and down like a little kid, you know, achieving his first bicycle ride, you know. And I did some things in it that related to kids. And I've had so many people come up to me in the years that have passed that, you know, said, wow, man, you know, you scared the death out of me with one hand, but I loved your character with another, because they related to the childlike mannerisms, you know?
Well, there's almost a sense, too, when you're watching, especially Superman 2. Obviously, in Superman, your roles are brief, but in Superman 2, they're fleshed out. But there's almost a quality of that Zod is almost a parent at this point, taking care of Non, and you're always kind of looking at him for approval.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, is that kind of how you played it?
Oh, yeah. No, positively. Okay. You know, it was so it actually carried over to the audience, you know?
Right.
And it worked out very well. You know, I was pleased with what we did, and Donner would loved it, and it's just very sad that Dick Donner didn't get to finish two, because he would have then directed three and four and five. I mean, they would have done the 10 Supermen they originally were going to do.
Well, give us the background on that, because basically what had happened was Richard Donner was hired on as the director for Superman, the movie.
Well, the original director was Guy Hamilton.
Right, he couldn't make that. Yeah,
he
couldn't.
He was a tax exile, so right. They
couldn't shoot it in London,
and you know, so they went to Donner, who loved Superman. I mean, he knew everything about it. He loved it, the American icon. Him and Tom Mankiewicz, who's a very clever writer,
brilliant.
Tom and he got together, and they just lived, eat, and slept Superman.
Well, were you a Superman fan originally?
Well, everybody, when you're a kid, you know, you touch base with Superman. You know, as much of a childhood as I had, which wasn't a lot. You know, I knew everything about Superman. You know, and you know, he was. I mean, this is what's wrong with what they're doing today. Superman is an American iconic superhero, and he's American driven. You know, and to take away the American way, to change the costume, to make a dark movie like they just did, to me is ridiculous. They're going away from the original concept of what the character's about.
There's definitely a lighter spirit with the films that you worked on.
It was more palatable. Mm-hmm. So, let's say to people, you know, that here's this American superhero, you know. Yeah. And the way he took care of people and protected people and did things that he had a righteousness about him, you know.
Right.
It wasn't about slaughtering or killing a lot of people to make an end. He would go out of his way to protect as many of those people as he could while he took care of the adversities, you know, as he did in Superman 1 and 2. I mean...
Well, at the end of Superman 2, he takes the battle north.
He did it so he could get it so people wouldn't get harmed.
Right.
You know, I mean, he did everything to protect people. And in the last couple Superman they did, you know, it's they had no script. Neither one of the last two Supermen had a real script.
You're talking about like 3 and 4?
I'm talking about Superman Returns and
the latest
Man of
ones.
Steel. Yeah, the last two, three and four were diabolical. Four was terrible. Four was done by Cannon.
Come on, there's a little charm. There's a tiny bit of charm. There's a little bit.
It wasn't done by a major. It wasn't done by Warner Brothers. It was done by Cannon Films.
Right.
Christopher wrote the script himself.
It's a little tough to watch, but there is a slight bit of charm in there.
Well, there's always going to be charm in the fact that Superman.
I'm probably biased.
Well, they didn't. You know what they didn't do is they didn't lose that American way with him.
You referenced earlier Richard Lester, so give the audience a little bit of background. Let's go back in time a little bit. When you and all the principals were hired on for the initial movie, and we'll clear up some things here. You were hired on for two films, correct?
Yeah.
You were hired on to film Superman 1 and Superman 2.
We were hired on with two films, and the dialogue was that they were actually going to do 10 of them.
Okay. But as you're shooting Superman 1, you're shooting Superman 2, and you're paid for both, correct?
We got paid for both. Well, we got paid for, we're shooting both of them.
I mean, it was the understanding of the crew that we're shooting two films.
Yeah, but they, you know, this was a Salkind trick that they used to do, man. You know, they. In fact, there's a law in the Directors Guild.
The Salkind Clause.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were notorious, and I didn't know. I knew they were producers, you know, when I came over to do the picture, and here we're doing a $50 million picture, And in doing so, I went to see, and I was talking to Donner. They had already started because they were building the models and they were putting things together and setting things up. And the whole crew was there lined up to get paid, and they wouldn't accept the check. They wanted cash. And I said to Tom, David Tomlin, I said, what is that all about? Oh, he said, you don't know about the salt kinds. I said, well,
this is as you're filming. This is as you're filming.
Well, this is before we even started.
Oh, okay.
He said, they're kind of the notorious people, man. He said, they've taken crews behind the Iron Curtain and got them back there and said, an investor fell out and you either take half salary or go home. You know, they did diabolical things like that. So people didn't trust them too much, evidently. So, but it was a big movie and everybody, you know, went to work on it, but they wanted their cash, you know.
Right. Now, you're shooting two movies as you're going. Halfway through, or about three quarters, I guess, of the way through.
Well,
they have to finish one.
What they were doing was we were doing one and two together, and they were so hung up on two because it was such a great movie that they had to stop and go back and finish one because it had a release date. But while we were working, Richard Lester appeared on the set, and the buzz started. And, you know, when we finished one and they wrapped it and we were coming back because we had to come back to finish two.
Now, this is the Superman had premiered by this time.
Superman 1 had premiered. Superman the movie had premiered. Right. And
you're coming, you're called back. Right.
To do. We knew we had to come back to do two.
Right.
And
which was about three quarters in the can.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we found out that in the interim of one being released, that they fired Richard Donner. And Gene Hackman never went back. Hackman said, no Donner, no me.
Okay, but he wasn't contractually obligated to come back?
No. In fact, when we were working, they went over his deal and he charged them a fortune. I mean, he really...
Oh, okay. So he actually had a deal in place on one. They went over the shooting days, so they were still owing him...
Well, he knew he was doing one and two, but they went past his contractual time.
That clears that one up.
To work.
Got it.
So they had to pay him an enormous amount of money to keep him there, and he did. He stayed there until we finished one, and then they... when we come back to do two, and what they did was they owed Lester a picture.
Right.
And they knew they were going to release Donner. I mean, they come up with all these lame excuses, but Donner was so into the film. I mean, there was no way in God's name they should have ever released him.
Right.
And they did, but they did because they didn't want to pay him, and they didn't. And Lester, they had already had a deal in place, and then when Lester came in. To be a director of record, you have to shoot more than 50% of the movie. So they went back and started redoing stuff, and he got carried away, and he redid like 80% of the picture.
Yeah, and that's why when you see the movie now, it's as a kid when I'm watching it, I never noticed anything, to be honest. But now that I'm looking back at it, even in the scene in the Daily Planet right before the big battle at the end, it goes back like – Margot Kidder's appearance just goes back and forth. So you see there's this stuff, the Donner shot, stuff that Lester shot. Yeah, you don't notice that when you're a kid. But
And they also, Lester was a laboratory guy. You know, in other words, he would fix it in the lab. So
fix it in post.
They went to Paris. When we went to Paris to shoot the Eiffel Tower stuff.
Right.
It was raining so bad that day. And in fact, if you look at the film, if you watch Superman 2, you'll see the cop gets drops on his shirt while he's interviewing Margot. While he's talking to Margot.
It is rain all over the cars.
And the windshield wipers are going like crazy behind him, you know? But it looks like a sunny day because he took it in the laboratory and lightened it up, you know? But they went into Paris under the name of Annie Oakley. Productions. It was unbelievable what these guys did. Anyway, say they, you know, Lester did what Lester does, and you know, it was such great material, and the cast was a great cast, and you know, everybody was into the roles. Although a lot of people were very disgruntled about Donner not coming back,
and
the guy who should have stood up was Christopher. Christopher said, "No Donner, no me." and that would have changed. They would have brought Donner back.
Now, would he have that option to do that, or was he contractually obligated, and that's why he didn't?
I don't think anybody is that contractually obligated. You know, if you change something like that, and you have a voice, and you say, you know what, I give me back the original director,
yeah,
or I'm not working. That's all there is to it. You know,
what was the differences?
Like Hackman just said, you know, and what they did, they doubled Hackman where they needed to. They just showed his back.
Yeah,
they had a lot of footage of him, and they cut it very cleverly. They had a lot of footage of him, and they were some shots where he should have been there, and they just used that. You see his back, and it's not him.
We see when they're on the going through the Arctic wasteland there, long shots of them on the snowmobile, and when he's dropped in at the Fortress of Solitude, he's climbing down. Yeah. You can see his back at the. And they got a voice double too, I think. So, describe the difference of working with Richard Donner and Richard Lester on these two films.
Night and day. I mean, Richard Donner is a brilliant actor, a brilliant director.
What would he do to help you with your performance?
He let you go. You know, he gave you what he asked you for. What he want? I asked him, "What do you want?" And then he would just let me go, you know, and I gave it to him. I never had a problem in front of the camera in any picture I ever did. You know, I was a one-take, two-take guy. The industry came very natural to me. I had a great teacher, you know, and then I had the opportunity to work with people like Brando and Omar Sharif and Jimmy Coburn and Gene Hackman in a couple pictures and Max von Sydow, you know, you're talking about great talent, you know, and I learned a lot from every one of them, you know.
What was Brando like on set?
Brando and I became real good friends because he knew my father and he knew I was a fighter and he loved boxing and he and I became really good friends. Brando was like Mitchum. He's a total class act. You know, when Brando come on the set, you could hear a pin drop. He commanded respect. I mean, he just had that aura about him, you know.
What was it like to watch him? Because you shared a scene with him. What was it like to just watch him just go off as Jor-El?
He's just a brilliant actor. You know, he's a stone method actor. That was the last picture that he lost a lot of weight for. He really got into the role. He's just such a God-born actor. I mean, he's just such a natural actor. The guy's, when I did Farewell, My Lovely, the first day I worked, and I remember when they did the first setup, and then we were done the shot, and they were taking things down. I looked at Mitchum, and I said, "Man, that's all there is to this?" He said, "That's it, kid, the whole enchilada." And I said, "Damn, I'm a star, man." And he laughed, and that became the logo of the picture, you know, that I was now a star. So I asked him one day, I said, "You know, what is this star business, man? What is it, you know, what is the categorization? What do you define a star?" And he laughed at me, he looked at me, he said, "You know what, kid? The word star," he said, "a person has a thing called presence." He said, "You go to a movie theater and you see Brando or Gregory Peck or, you know, Jimmy Stewart, and you come out of the theater and you say, 'Oh man, Brando was great doing this and he was great doing that.'" He said, or Jimmy Stewart was great, and Jimmy Stewart was great doing that. He said, "Then you have a guy like William Holden, who was a very good actor, but he had no presence. And you come out of the theater and you say, 'Wow, what's his name? Boy, he was so good at that. But what's that guy's name?'" And people didn't remember his name because he didn't have the presence that some people have. It's a natural gift that you can't teach that. Jimmy Dean had it. I mean, there are certain actors that just have a stone presence on the screen. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I think that's the case with Brando and Hackman. Do you find yourself as an actor when you're sharing scenes with people like this, do you find yourself fighting the urge to watch them because you're supposed to be in the scene with them?
No, you want to play, you know. I got involved, and you know, you want to match energies with them, you know.
Did it amp up your performance?
I think it always, whenever I worked with calibers of people like that, it's like Mitchum taught me something day one. I remember the very first day we went to work, and we were standing, and the first scene we ever did was in that bar, and we're standing at the bottom of the steps, and we're going to walk up into this scene, and he said to me, have you read that script, kid? And I said, yeah, I've read it. I said, I know my role, your role, Charlotte Rampling's role, this guy's role. I said, I wired it, man. He said, good, throw it in the trash can. I said, what? He said, don't let me catch you doing what thousands of people in this town do. Act. Just be yourself. Just do this like you would be out on that street out there doing one of your hustles. Just be you. Just be yourself. And he was right, you know. And I remember we got up in front of the camera. It was the first time I was ever in front of a camera. And he said to me, you see all those guys behind that camera there looking important? I said, yeah. He said, don't ever let any of them bother you. Well, I said, they ain't going to bother me anyway. It's just my nature. He said, because when that red light goes on, kid, they all work for you. You're on celluloid. They're not. They can be replaced. You can't. Wow. And he just taught me from day one, you know, and it just it worked out well. Farewell, My Lovely worked out very well, but it gave me the confidence of this acting gig stuff, you know. Great and every advice. Picture I did, King Kong, you know, I worked with Jeffrey Bridges and Jessica was her first picture, and we walked her through with it. And Charlie Gruden's a great actor, you know. And then to turn around and work with Jimmy Coburn and Omar Sharif, who was a brilliant guy. I got the chance to work with a lot of really good actors in my career, and I enjoyed it. You know, I thoroughly enjoy. I love being in front of the camera. It's I should have done a lot more of it, and I'm getting ready to go back and do a lot of it. I got like three pictures lined up right now.
Oh, good for your fans to hear. Before we get into that, well, what was it like to work with Christopher Reeve?
Christopher was a good kid, you know. He was a kid. He had a young mind for an older guy. He was young thinking, you know, and he was very stuck on walking around as his character, which some actors get into that. They can't separate real life, you know, and that was made him a bit immature in my eyes. And we had a few dissertations in the way of shooting, but you know, when you have
when you say that, what does that mean? Because you're 6'6". I mean, it's
well, you know,
you get into the little row with Jack O'Halloran, and there's, you know, it's can't keep that one quiet.
There was one altercation that could have come to a serious stupidity, and he said something really dumb and did something really dumb, and he made me really angry, and I had him against the wall, and I was getting ready, and Richard Donner came up behind me and said, "Not in the face, Jack, not in the face."
Were you method acting as Non?
Oh no!
He was channeling the Man of Steel.
I was me.
It probably led to a great performance because you guys had to go toe to toe in the film.
Yeah, I mean, we put it aside, and well, you know, you work with people, you respect people for certain things, and Christopher, let me tell you something, they will never find another Christopher Reeve.
Agreed.
You're never going to, this kid, you got to understand something. Christopher never did anything before Superman.
Yeah.
He did A Love of Life. He did a couple plays in New York. But he was a Juilliard graduate, you know, come from a very wealthy family. And he was a 170-pound skinny kid. I talked to the trainer how to build him out. Build him to where, when he puts that suit on, because he didn't want to wear any board underneath or anything. He wanted his own body. I said, build it where you can actually see a six-pack on him. You know, build definition in his body.
That was Darth Vader working him out.
Yeah, that's exactly who it was. Yeah.
David Prowse you were talking
to. Yeah, David. Yeah. And he was a weightlifter, you know. And so I said, you don't want to bulk him. You want to cut him. Make him cuts, man. And they did that. They trained him real smartly. And Christopher put on about 30 pounds and did it wisely. And he looked great. I mean, you can't deny the results, you know. He looked terrific. And he was just a natural Clark Kent Superman. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for them to find somebody to outdo what Christopher Reed did.
Still to this day, the best one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they should have had him for 10, though. He should have done 10 of those movies. And he would have had they handled it correctly.
Yeah. Well, you know? Talk about the flying sequences and the battle sequences that you had to go through, because you were there was a little bit of danger involved in that.
We broke a lot of technology in that. We set a lot of technical rules. I mean, we shot VistaVision on VistaVision. We had this big 70-foot screen, and they had pole arms that came through the screen, and body molds that were at the end of them, and we laid in the mold and got dressed. And they shot VistaVision on VistaVision, so they were actually shooting you in the movie, so you could fly around the buildings, under the bridges, and without wires. You understand?
Right.
So it gave it such an authenticity. It was brilliant, you know, but it was very tedious and long. And when we did it, the first day we went up in these molds, and oh my God, Margot had a heart attack, and so did Sarah. You know, we're looking down at 70 foot of concrete.
And you've got her on your back on a few of the scenes.
Yeah, well, we're looking at 70 foot of concrete below us, you understand? So
You're up that high.
I said, somebody better put some mats or something down there, because if God forbid, well, those molds will never break. I said, really? And I broke one of the legs on my mold. I said, oh, my God, what happened? You said it wouldn't break? And, oh, geez, that was terrible.
And you got hurt, but too, didn't you? One scene?
Yeah.
What was the scene where you got hurt?
Well, it was from the hyperextension of the flying shots.
Okay.
I hurt my back pretty bad, but you know, it's we had some adversities on the deal with the harnesses. That we had a harness for, because we did some of the flying shots with wires, you know, and the landing shots on the water and stuff where we come out of the sky,
right?
You're on wires, and the harnesses. These guys went through like. Six or seven harness makers, and the harnesses were cutting us, and they were hurting Sarah's ribs, and Terrence was very uncomfortable with his. And so I suggested to the guy, I said, you know, there's a guy that works for MGM. He did the harnesses for us for King Kong and several other pictures, and you ought to call him on the phone. And Delia said to me, really? I said, yeah, man. I said, just call special effects at MGM and ask for, I had the guy's name at the time. I said, ask for so-and-so. And I said, I'm guaranteed he'll sort this harness business out for you lickety-split. They were spending a fortune on harnesses that none of them worked. And they were too big. They were too awkward. And this guy did. He adapted a harness, and boom, off we were running, you know?
Nice.
So we stood together on certain things. If something wasn't right, then we would stand together on it and say, you know, you got to fix this. That's all there is to it. We were doing flying shots when we come into the Daily Planet. Yeah.
Okay. This is after the battle's over. Superman flies off. You're coming back in.
And when we're flying, we did that on I think it was FH stage, where we fly and go through the windows and come into the Daily Planet. Yeah.
Right.
And so they were pulling us by hand on these tracks. You know, we're hanging by wires and harnesses and you know, boom, and they pull us by hand, and you know, English crews, when you go to lunch, they have a few brews, and and everybody's timing isn't exactly correct, I guess, you know. So and there were, again, you're up in the air, like 30 feet up in the air, and there's nothing below you but floor. And I said to the guy, Gary Medic, I'll never forget it, I said, How secure are these wires, man? Oh, Jack, they hold a lot of weight. No, I said, no problem, man. So I started doing flips. And he said, what are you doing? I said, well, you told me that these things were no problem. They would hold everybody's weight doing what they want, because Sarah was scared to death. And I said, you know, and I was trying to get break the tension, you know what I mean?
Right.
For a little bit. I said, you know, you got to, if this thing snaps, sunshine, and it breaks, and I hit that floor, you better pray that I can't get up.
Especially in your battle armor.
I said, you better pray that I cannot get up off that floor.
Wow.
And he got nervous as hell. And everybody laughed.
But one of your stuntmen, did fall on one of them, though, didn't he? Was it in the fortress?
Yeah. Well, what? You know, you just had you had to ask, because they did things without safety deals, and you know, Sarah and Terrence was petrified. Jeez, he said, man, what are they doing this? And I said, man, it's okay, don't worry about it. So I went out and did these flips and stuff, and everybody got laughing and stuff, and we did the shot and got it over with, you understand?
Yeah.
And we did that in a few places, where if there was a controversial deal, we just we got together and we stuck together and we laughed through a lot of things. You know, there was a lot of things that were tedious and a lot of things that were a bit of a pain. Doing that glass thing was a pain, because we were on a hot stage and you had this plastic in front of you, and you know, you're leaning against this plastic to get the effect and everything, and it was a long, tedious shot for Dick to get what he wanted.
I have to ask you, I don't know if that's what you were just referring to, but I have to ask you this one question. There's a scene in the Fortress of Solitude where Superman appears, you take off full force at him, and he pulls off the cellophane S.
Oh, that was Lester's bullshit. That was Richard
Even
Lester.
As a kid... I love this film, and I'm watching it, and nobody saw this thing more than I did that summer. But even as a kid, I'm watching this going, what did I just see?
Yeah, well, that's what
Do you have any idea what that is?
Well, I don't know. It was Lester had this idea that Superman had a way of defending him. I don't know.
What is it? What
nobody
is that
knew.
Thing?
I mean, I guess he had a layered S, you know?
That's a big plastic baggy S. Do you still have it?
No.
Because somebody has to have that thing, because at one point it is a plastic wrap that envelops you.
Well, actually, they did a lot of that by camera.
Okay, well, the first shot is animated, and then there's a shot where it wraps around you, and there's some type of cellophane around you, the actor. So were you wrapped in something at some point?
Not really. I did all the fit configurations like I was.
Okay. Because it looks like at one point there's some type of plastic, and then it turns into a computer-generated model that disappears.
No, it was all computer-generated.
Okay.
And it was well done, the computer generation.
For what it was.
Talking, yeah. I mean, whatever it is. Kind of stupid, whatever it was, is right.
Have you seen the Family Guy spoof on it?
I heard about it.
Okay.
I heard about it.
Yeah, he's like, hey, that was irritating. Yeah, sure.
You know,
take
it was
that.
Just kind of it was kind of a dumb deal, man. But you know, so you're called upon.
It's not a Richard Donner thing.
Yeah, you're called upon to do your skills as an actor. You do shit like that. You know, that's
classic.
What you're paid for.
All right, yeah, that just clears it up for me. I love that. But you know, one thing we talked earlier about Lester came in, but recently we've got Superman 2, the Richard Donner cut. Have you seen that?
It's much better.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
I've seen it, and one thing I notice about it, first of all, it's a much different film. If anybody listening has not seen it, go get it. It's a standalone DVD. Yeah. It's also in the Superman set. And at the end, spoiler alert for anybody that hasn't seen the Donner cut, but it has actually the ending from Superman 1. That was originally intended for that.
We actually shot where we get locked up in the police cars.
Well, there's a couple different alternatives. That's what I wanted to ask you about. There's a couple different versions. If the Donner cut proper, you guys are sent back to the Phantom Zone. He turns back time, and you guys are sent back into the Phantom Zone as if the whole movie never happened. Obviously, they can't use that because they use that in Superman 1. But when you look at a deleted scene from Superman 2, there you guys are being taken off by the U.S. Arctic Patrol. You guys are loaded up into the paddy wagons along with Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
So So what's worse, being trapped in the Phantom Zone or the Arctic Patrol prison?
I went back to them with a storyline of us coming back.
Because you guys are still alive in that cut.
Yeah. I went back with them with a storyline for one of the new Supermans, with us coming back and Zah and myself having my lobotomy reversed and going back to studying while I was in jail and coming back with being able to talk and
stuff. You got your degree? You got your degree in the Arctic Patrol prison?
In the prison, you know.
That's awesome.
So they liked it, but then they went away with what they did, and which was stupid. But
I would love to have seen that. That would make a great comic book series.
Oh, it would have been great. You know,
get to see Non like all of a sudden start spouting Shakespeare and things and talking. Yeah, and then like he takes over Zod, and like Zod has to roll his eyes then. Oh,
yeah,
that'd be fantastic.
Right there.
That'd be fantastic. Well, hey, I'd be all for it. Hey, speaking of comic books, we talked about Richard Donner writing with Jeff Johns. He had written this whole backstory as a comic book for him. Did you ever get a chance to read that?
Yeah.
What'd you think of it?
I thought it was great. Dick's, like I said, Dick is a Superman fanatic, man. If they would have let him go, he would have come up with some phenomenal stuff.
That's kind of when you hear interviews when he's doing interviews.
He would have come up with some phenomenal things.
I think we would have had at least four good Christopher Reeve films,
five or six maybe. That would have been you would have had a franchise that would have stood out, really stood out. And the ironic part of it is you're talking about a lot of money, and I just don't sometimes I just shake my head at some of the people in the industry with things like that because here we are. We're 40 years later, and it's still the movie stands up as good as if we did it yesterday.
I watched it the other day. It hasn't lost anything.
No,
hasn't lost anything. I put it. It's still my favorite. I've seen Man of Steel. I like Superman Returns. I like Man of Steel. The ending.
Superman Returns had so much CGI. It was terrible. It had a great cast hanging around saying nothing.
Well, what I enjoyed about it was that it sort of put a nice bookend on the Donner years that Superman 3 and 4 didn't do.
But it made made Lois Lane look like a hooker.
Need
to be there. And the CGI was so over the top. And you had a great actor like Kevin Spacey who, how do you fill Hackman's shoes?
That's tough.
You just don't. Kevin's a good actor, but he's never going to duplicate what Hackman did.
It's tough.
So why even go there?
Still has one of my favorite lines in there, where you are three, and then you grunt, and he says, four if you count them twice. He just sells that. Nobody sells that line better than Hackman.
Well, Hackman was great. Hackman's a great actor. I mean, you have to.
Did you get to goof around with him on set?
Oh, I knew Hackman. Gene and I were good friends.
Yeah,
Gene's a good guy. I mean, we did two pictures. Like we did March or Die for 6 months before we came on the Superman.
Did he ever just look at you and go like, "Can you believe we're doing this? We're doing Superman."
He liked the idea because he liked Donner.
Okay.
No, he respected Donner. You got to understand, Gene is a methodical actor. Gene Hackman, I mean, if you're a director and you don't do your homework, boy, man, he'll walk right away. We were doing Watch or Die, and Dick Richards, God bless him, man. He's a nice guy and everything, but he wasn't the director that he wanted to be. And Hackman used to tell him, "Go home and do your homework, and when you get done, I'll come."
Wow. He would say that to the director.
Oh, yeah. When you put Hackman on a set and then start moving him around, you didn't do your homework.
No problem with Donner, though.
No, Donner was a great Donner. Donner's you're talking about a great director. You're really talking about a great director. He'll never get the credit that he deserves as a director. He's The guy is a great director.
Well, I'm telling you what, I saw this film when I was a kid, and man, I'm telling you what, he made me believe a man could fly. I mean, he really did.
Oh yeah, no, no doubt about it. The whole backstory and everything, he did so well. Superman 1 was done well. And that's one of the parts of Man of Steel that bothers me is that, you know, Kevin Costner's playing the father, and he's telling the kid, hide your identity no matter what, and watch people die. Well, Superman wouldn't watch people die.
I tell you what, it's funny you mentioned that. When I first saw the trailer, I said, I hope they take that line out of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's so stooge, man. That's bad.
It's in there. I like the film. But I love the first two Superman films, so there's the difference. I think it's
they're very hard. They haven't dented us yet. Let's say that.
Oh no, and be honest, they're not going to.
Dentists, no.
No, those are two perfect films. It captures the spirit perfectly. Your performance, the three Kryptonian villains are unbelievable. You're never going to top them as villains. And it's just there's a sense that you guys had fun.
We actually did. I mean, you know, it was, and we're today. Sarah's a dear, dear friend of mine, and I don't see Terrence, but if I saw him tomorrow, it would be like we were yesterday. You know.
Did you hear the story about him recently? I don't know if it's true or not, but these people were in a bath or in a men's room, and they were talking about how Man of Steel was good. I don't know if there's truth to the story, but. They're talking about how good Man of Steel was, but they said it doesn't come close to the Superman 2. And Terrence happens to be in the restroom, and he's like, you're a very perceptive individual.
That sounds like Terrence.
I don't know if there's any truth to that story, but I've read it like a million times, and I'm just like...
That sounds like Terrence.
Could you imagine that?
Terrence is a really, real strict Englishman, man. I mean, he's just a class act. Terry's a class act right down the street. I got to tell you something.
Do you run into any of these guys? I mean, obviously not those.
I haven't seen Terrence in a long time. I see Sarah all the time. Sarah was just here in America. I'm putting a project together that I want her to work on. Sarah's just a dear friend and a very, very good person.
Well, you mentioned,
and so is Terry.
You mentioned you've got a couple projects coming up. Is this one of them that you referred to?
Yeah.
Okay. What are some of the? I mean, you're getting back in acting again now.
Yeah. Yeah. I have three films that I'm getting ready to do. One is called In Name Only, which is going to be shot in New York. Then I have a picture called Kickback, which is we may do in Prague. We may do some of it in New York and Prague. And then there's a product that I'm going to do in London at Pinewood in December.
Where you shot Superman.
Yeah, and these are kids who did a project last year called Requiem for Superman, which they did very well with, actually. And I did a voiceover for them, so I'm doing this thing called Return to Purgatory, and I play this archangel that protects heaven, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat deal.
And, this is, well, that's talk about playing against type. That's a much different role for you.
Yeah, I kind of am looking forward to it. And, you know, so I've got my book that we're making into a film, Family Legacy, and we're going to do a television series out of it. And I'm getting ready to write the prequel. And I have another book called Gray Cloud that I'm writing, which is another story that involves China. And it's a pretty neat deal. And that's going forward pretty well.
And you're building studios too, correct?
Yeah,
or have built studios?
We're getting in the process of purchasing Culver City Studios, which looks like in the next 2 weeks we'll have pretty much headway of getting it done. So
you're going to be your own studio executive?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
From dealing like with that. Them to becoming your own studio executive. How does somebody go up against Non? I mean, that's
somebody has to turn some things around in this industry, you know? Putting a studio together, this is you're talking about one of the stalwart studios in the business. This is where Gone with the Wind was done, and it was owned by the Joseph Kennedy and Howard Hughes, and Lucy and Desi owned it. It's a great, great old studio, but kept up. Yeah, a lot of history. And it's very well kept up. It's a nice little 13 soundstage studio sitting in Culver City next to the Sony studio. And it's we're going to have a lot of fun.
Oh, you're taking on a lot of new challenges. Do you get to go to comic conventions? Do you kind of go to these places?
I didn't do Comic-Con this year because it's just such a zoo down there, and I have so much on my plate. But I did a show in Knoxville, and I do a show here and there because it's only fair to the people, you know. I enjoy doing them because I like going out and seeing the people that and it always amazes me how 40 years later, you know, people look at the Superman films so diligently still, you know, and it's like you have like four generations of kids that that have come up through this and you still have young children watching it like it was done yesterday. And being awed by it, and that's kind of cool. You know, I like it, and so I'm glad that we were able to put something like that on the screen that would last in perpetuity.
Hey, how can fans get in touch with you? Is there? I know you're on Facebook.
Yep.
Upcoming appearances, your book, all your projects that you've got going on. How do we find out about that?
There's a site I have, www.familylegacythenovel.com.
Thank you, sir, for being part of the show today. We really appreciate your time, and thank you for these two perfect films.
Hey, listen, it's my pleasure, and thank you.
Big thanks to Jack O'Halloran for hanging out in the lair today and celebrating the 35th anniversary of Superman the movie. Be sure to check out Jack's website and novel, Family Legacy, at familylegacythenovel.com. And if you're a fan of Indiana Jones, be honest, who isn't? My friend Keith Voss and I are talking indie comics over at the IndieCast.
Tune in each fortnight to the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones fan podcast.
Trust me.
Featuring the latest news, reviews, and interviews with on-screen and behind-the-scenes talent who help bring to life the greatest adventure movie series ever made. Each episode has the latest from the world of Indiana Jones, as well as interactive segments, trivia, contests, and specials, including radio dramas and music retrospectives. The IndieCast.
It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
Available in iTunes or listen directly at theindiecast.com.
If adventure has a name, it must be the IndieCast.
And as always, thanks to Derek Cook over at MonsterKidRadio.net for all the shout-outs, and Jim Bowers over at CapeWonder.com, an amazing resource for tons of Superman the movie images. Trev Murphy for the scary sketch art of Jack O'Halloran. Check out Trev's creative side at TrevMurphy.com. And the team at SupermanHomepage.com, site for all things Superman. And make sure you check out every episode of Comic Book Central. The website is ComicBookCentral.net, or you can subscribe on iTunes. Give it a like on Facebook at facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network, and go crazy with the tweeting at Comic Book CTRL. Be sure to drop me a line and tell me what you think of the show as well, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Well, that's all the time we have for today. So enjoyed celebrating Superman the movie's 35th anniversary with Non himself, Jack O'Halloran. That was a great time. After I wrap here, I think I'm going to go watch Superman the movie and Superman 2 again. And don't forget, the Super Celebration continues next week with the creator, executive producer, and writer of Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, Deborah Joy Levine, will be here. Until then, kids, keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
It was great. What a great interview.